as you can imagine, somebody like me with the title of Dean of the School of the Coast and Environment at Louisiana State University, which is 100 nautical miles plus from the well site that we had the problem with, would be heavily involved in this situation, and that is exactly what happened. Before I begin my remarks, I would like to compliment the President's Oil Spill Commission on what was, I think, a fine effort. They worked awfully hard, and I have seen them in public fora in which they have been called every possible name you can imagine. They've been told that they are in the pockets of BP, or that they're in the pockets of the federal government, or that they're in somebody's pockets. And I guess that's a good sign. If you've got everybody angry at you, it means you probably did a pretty good job. But they are in nobody's pockets. They didn't get paid for this. It was, I think, a selfless act of American heroism that really deserves more credit. So I applaud you, Terry, for what you did. Well, what I aim to cover today is simple. I want to talk about the very challenging science of the BP Macondo spill, and the word spill is used advisedly here. It was a gusher. It was a blowout. It was really a serious problem. I'd like to talk to you about what we know and what we don't know. I want to transition from the science into the challenge of marshaling our nation's intellectual capital in a time of crisis, something that it turns out is a very difficult thing to do. I would like to talk a little bit about the funding concerns that we have for dealing with events like this and their aftermath, something that the President's Commission did point out was a considerable concern, and then give some personal thoughts and recommendations, which I hope will provoke you to think about this issue and where we might go in the future. I want to really mention that Louisiana has a huge stake in this for a million different reasons. 40% of the nation's coastal wetlands are in Louisiana. These are extremely productive, important areas for fisheries and all kinds of natural resources, everything from ducks to you name it. And so it's a very, very important area that we need to preserve. It has the highest seafood landings of any other state but Alaska, so it's a very important commercial fishing area. And this really is right near the Macondo well site. It suffered the greatest environmental impacts, I believe, of any state. And that is really something that is still causing our economy to reel. And ironically enough, the oil and gas production and petrochemical industry that we have are both very vital for all of the U.S., and that these activities occur in close proximity to where all of our wonderful natural resource treasures exist. So that creates an inherent conflict and a huge challenge for our state as we try to manage problems like we faced. Now, as you are probably aware, I won't go into the history of drilling offshore, but we're going deeper and deeper because we're exhausting the shallow pools. My colleague, John Roger Smith, an engineering petroleum engineer at LSU, has given me this slide, which I think really illustrates the kinds of problems and challenges that we face in dealing with the deep water drilling that we're doing. It's a very difficult and complex environment. It's a remote place that's hard to reach with equipment. There are all kinds of new operations. It's much more complex than you would normally have to deal with in a shallow situation or, indeed, on land. There is a higher risk of drilling operations, as we've all too well learned, and the error margins are narrow. There are many more people on site, many more people at risk. And then there's also the other side of it, which is it's a very high production rate. Which is to say, if something goes wrong, that stuff can come gushing out at a very, very fast clip. Now, I'm putting some LSU events and spill milestones on up for you just to give you a smattering of what we've had to deal with. And I'm not trying to be LSU-centric here. I have a point I want to make in putting up some of these things. But April 20th, we know the explosion occurred. The vessel sank on the 22nd, killing 11 workers. We started living, breathing, sleeping, eating oil on April 30th. I don't think I took a day off last May, and, you know, none of us had a life. Tony Hayward was right. A lot of people wanted their lives back, not the least of which were high-level officials in the federal government who were consumed with this. May 10th was the first of our high-level federal official visits, and we've had a bunch of them, and serial visits, I might say. We briefed Lisa Jackson at LSU on dispersants. So I really give Lisa a lot of credit for coming out and trying to get the scientific community involved and hearing what we had to say. The problem is the way our system is set up does not make it easy to have a close relationship and continue those kinds of discussions. I'll get to that in a while later. We also hosted the Consortium of Ocean Leadership's Science Summit, which helped to improve the coordination and discussion between the feds and the academic side. And all of this within really a month and a half of the spill. That made for some exciting times. In June, BP made initial grants for what they called the Gulf Research Initiative. And this was very helpful because it was hard to get money for academics to get out and do the research that needed to be done. Fortunately, July 15th, 12 weeks after the gusher started, BP was able to install the cap. And I can tell you it was unsaid, but the worries that they would lose the casing and create a breach down to the deep water pool of oil that was existing was a very serious concern. They were afraid all of that oil in the reservoir was going to come up, and that would have created one heck of a mess. We had NOAA Administrator Jane Luchenco a visit on October 20th, and just recently the BP announced the year two of the two-year research program. They have committed a total of $500 million. They have spent about $40 million so far, and they intend to do an RFP. I've been quoted widely in the press and on NPR and other places about my concerns that there was a delay in funding and that the second year of funding is coming very late for many researchers, so that we're going to miss the valuable second season of research. And then finally, just this week, Michael Bromwich, Director of Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, came by. So you see a pattern here. We had a bunch of high-level officials taking real interest. These were not just political moves. They really wanted to hear what we had to say. But enfranchising the academic community is truly challenging for a lot of reasons which are not the federal government's fault. In making comments today, I'm not trying to single out some conscious error on the federal government or some conspiracy that they've come up with. I think that we have some structural problems in our laws and regulation that lead to this. Well, as you all remember, the spill rate kept growing, and this was creating all the more anxiety throughout Louisiana and other places as this went. I won't illustrate exactly the sequence here, but I'll just say that the final tally was 4.9 million barrels of oil spilled. Now, while there is a cap of 75 million in terms of punitive damage assessments, the fines for release of oil are not capped. And this can range between $1,100 a barrel and $4,300 a barrel, the latter being the case if gross negligence is determined. So as you can see, the BP financial liability remains, and you can expect a lot of discussion between the federal government and BP on what they come up with as the final answer. Is that correct, Dave?
Yes. A lot of discussion.
A lot of discussion.
A lot of lawyers.
But we're talking $15, $20 billion here is a very likely scenario. Now, May and June were very rapidly evolving times for us. The federal government's had three major things that it was trying to accomplish. Number one, first and foremost, they wanted to stop that gusher. So they were focused on that, and to do that, they had to learn about it, and in an engineering sense, they had to come up with reasonable estimates of how much was coming out, and a whole lot of other things. They wanted to do as much removal of oil as they possibly could through one of the three mechanisms they have, which is A, physically collect it, B, burn it off, or C, disperse it so that it becomes more subject to microbial degradation. I've used the term, the academic community was frustrated because we didn't have funding and we were not sure of how we fit into the federal process. I would say that still is a concern even today. There's something like 19 TWIGs, technical working groups, that we know relatively little about, and maybe Dave can address that in his remarks. I think it would be nice if we could find a way to breach that chasm. I like to use the analogy to the fog of war here. We had a fog of research going on. The complexity of a deep spill is mind-boggling. It's way away from you, where you can see it and study it easily. You have to use remotely operated vehicles. It's, in this case, operating under very, very harsh environmental conditions. We had limited access to the site because, obviously, they're trying to cap the well, and that's got to be the highest priority. So they're not going to let a bunch of scientists in there towing all kinds of vehicles and doing all kinds of hydrocasts. It's just going to make their job impossible. So the well site was appropriately restricted. That meant it was hard for anybody to know where the oil was going, and I'll get to that in a second. I think communication about the science was not very good. Don't forget, our federal officials were working 19, 20 hours a day just trying to figure out how to do the three major things they had to do. Science was never their biggest priority. It couldn't be, and certainly communication was extraordinarily difficult. Indeed, solutions to the problem were not coming very quickly. Lots of debate about the use of dispersants, lots of debate about burning the oil, lots of debate about how to cap the well. This comic sort of illustrates the feeling that people had about then. And it says, we're preparing to unveil the new equipment that we think might solve the spill, and then they unveil it, and it's a suggestion box, which is another amusing thing. Boy, did we get such suggestions. My name appeared in the paper a few times, and all of a sudden every inventor around the country called me. Some of them had ideas that were good, but some of them were a little bit off base. Okay, how does this spill compare to previous experiences? Terry's experienced both of these now through his role in the Exxon Valdez and the Deepwater Horizon. This is to illustrate a point, is that no two spills are alike. And indeed, the Deepwater Horizon was a very different spill than the Exxon Valdez was. The magnitude was substantially higher, as you can see. The Exxon Valdez was a medium crude with very little natural gas in it. The Deepwater Horizon is a very light and biodegradable crude, I might say, but also a bit more toxic, with a high natural gas content. The Exxon Valdez was a surface spill that occurred very rapidly, two-day period. This was a 12-week event, and so it was a slower spill rate, but this meant that it was a chronic continuing thing that just kept provoking anxiety. Two-thirds of the oil from Deepwater Horizon, they believe, maybe 50%, two-thirds, never reached the surface. So that is very different from the one in Alaska where everything was on the surface. The surface temperatures in Alaska were cool. The temperatures in Deepwater Horizon at depth were cool but warm on the surface. As you know, microbes degrade things in response to the temperature. So a higher temperature is good. Exxon Valdez was right at the shore, and the hydrographic and meteorological conditions kept the oil hugging the shore and impinging on the shore. In our case, the oil was a long way offshore, and for a lot of the time we dodged a bullet in that the hydrographic situation and driven by meteorological conditions, pushed the oil away from shore. And we had a couple of serious incidents where that was reversed and the oil came ashore, and we have all those images in our head from those things. In Alaska, it's a rocky coastline. We have a marsh area and sandy beaches to the east of us. They didn't do any burning in Alaska. We did a lot of burning. And Alaska had relatively slow biodegradation, microbial activity. The Gulf turned out had a lot of stuff going on, even at cold temperatures and depth. So what are my concerns with this is it was an extremely complex science problem. We didn't know what using dispersants at depth would be. Poor Lisa Jackson had to make a very gutsy decision based on relatively little information. And this is one of those things where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. There is no right answer. Using dispersants is the worst alternative except for all the others in many people's view. So Lisa made that decision, and now she's taken a lot of hits over it. We were concerned about the possibility of hypoxia developing, that the oil would pool and cause a real significant decline in oxygen, which would kill organism at depth or wherever the oil washed up ashore. I have not seen convincing evidence that it was substantial, and I think we're lucky there. The timing of the spill was not great in terms of the spawning season and the spring phytoplankton bloom and all that kind of stuff that occurs during this time of year. So we were very worried about the kind of biological effects that it might have on nearshore communities which sustain the fisheries. We're also concerned about the longer-term subtle impacts, the non-acute, the chronic impacts that will affect food webs and cause problems. And that's not easy information to tease out. It's all really almost secondhand kind of calculations. We were, of course, concerned with what the public was concerned with. They were worried about birds and turtles and whales and things like that because that's what they think the marine environment is about. But in the scientific community, our major concern was what goes on at the lower trophic levels. And then, obviously, the human public health issues were not well dealt with, and there was a lot of criticism on that one. To illustrate the point of the complexity of the circulation of the Gulf and the oil getting to the surface, you had this stuff jetting out at high temperatures with a lot of gas and a lot of pressure, and it was naturally being dispersed, I'm led to believe, by this condition. I've used the analogy of a cappuccino maker, and I've been roundly criticized for making oil sound too nice. But the fact is, this is hot stuff, steam boiling through something to make it miscible with water. This will help it disperse and make it more microbially degradable. The other thing it does is it, because of the viscosity of seawater and the smallness of the droplets, the micro droplets, it means that it can stay at depth instead of floating to the surface as you would normally expect for a substance like oil that is, in fact, lighter than seawater on a specific gravity basis. So there were a variety of things going on here. They were adding dispersants. The oil was coming up in through natural gas. And that meant that there were a bunch of different time horizons you might look at, from 4 hours, tens of hours, to hundreds of hours. That would mean the oil, when it did reach the surface, would come up in very different places. Now, also remember that the current is not unidirectional. Up on the surface, the meteorological conditions are driving the direction of current, so it may be going in one direction on the surface and in another direction at depth. Turns out that there was mainly a predominating southwesterly flow of water at depth, and on the surface it varied all over the place. So, for the people trying to figure out where this oil went, this is a pure nightmare. Models don't exist to make these calculations easy, and I have nothing but sympathy for the people in NOAA that were trying to put boundaries on estimating where the oil was. Now, we all know the images of oil, so I'm not going to dwell on these, but what are some of the concerns we would have about oil's effects? Well, first is toxicity, the most obvious one. Another one is smothering. When the oil, very thick oil, it weathers by the time it gets to shore. It's very different from what you see at the well site. It's largely the heavy, gunky residuals that can get all over birds and smother benthic areas, etc. Oxygen depletion caused by the degradation of the oil is another issue. And then there was a concern about carbon enrichment, which is to say that the organic carbon from the spill would change the trophic system and cause microbes to grow that were unusual for the environment and would create a problem in that sense. There were many kinds of oil that one had to deal with. This is another challenge. As I said, from the moment that the oil left the riser pipe and later the wellhead, it changed. It changed because the oil and natural gas would separate. It changed because the biodegradation would occur. And it changed because the volatile organic carbons, if they got to the surface, would blow off into the atmosphere and leave behind the asphaltenes and the other heavier fractions. So every aspect of the spill is different depending on where you are. And that's another important thing to understand. A final point to make is that, I'm losing my train of thought here.
Natural seeps.
Well, yes, natural seeps. Glad you mentioned it. That there are a lot of, that leads to my point, is right. What is BP oil and what is not BP oil? Everybody that saw anything black and gunky was coming in with samples saying this is oil from BP. There is a huge rate of natural seepage in the Gulf that occurs all the time, and that's actually beneficial to us because it has apparently resulted in a specially adapted microbial community that's able to deal with the oil in a faster way than other communities might. Now, we've had lots of involvement in this. Our EarthScan lab, part of my school, was called on to help with satellite imagery, and they did a great job. So the oil we could see on the surface, we had a pretty good idea where it was. And we knew where it was moving, and we had meteorological predictions of where it might hit. It's the oil at depth that we really didn't have a good handle on. So I won't dwell on these, but you get the idea, the invaluable role of satellite imagery in a situation like this is obvious. And God knows poor NOAA is challenged to keep satellites in the sky these days with the federal budget, and it's very tragic. The Louisiana region is mostly marshy shoreline. I'm not going to have time to really go through this. I just want to illustrate the point that if you're going to worry about biological effects, Louisiana is the place where you really worry the most, and it's where the 60% of the oil actually did come ashore. So it was the heaviest oiled part of the whole mix. If you get to the east of us, they're mostly beaches. Louisianans go to the shore to eat seafood, and when they want to go to the beach, they go east as far as they can, and vice versa. Sandy beaches are less in danger than wetlands, and there's been a hue and cry from our neighbors to the east about how they should get the bulk of any money that comes out of this, and we've been sort of scratching our heads saying, well, yeah, but Louisiana got more of it and was probably more vulnerable to begin with. You've seen the oil pictures. The oil changes color. It looks different. It's heavier, gunkier when it gets to shore. It coats absolutely everything. We learned from Exxon Valdez that there are a lot of things you don't do, and trying to remove it is often something you don't do. It's just no way around it. It has to be naturally degraded in many cases. The worst and hardest hit was in Barataria Bay, where Bay Jimmy exists. And you hear about Bay Jimmy, and you hear Billy Nungesser get on TV and scream about Bay Jimmy all the time. But it was bad, and you could see along the margins of the shore, you can see in the marsh, you can see areas of dieback. Now, this can recover with time. It all depends on how severe the oiling was. This is what Bay Jimmy looked like on March 31st, a little before the growing season, and it has improved somewhat since, but there's still oil in that area. So there are indeed certain areas that are heavily affected by the acute effects of the spill, but fortunately most of Louisiana and other parts are not. Now, this is a point that in a way I'm nervous about including this in any publication or any video that might be on the web or something, but it's an important point. The spill was huge by any dimension, but the Gulf is immense. It's gigantic, or as one of my former colleagues used to say, it's ginormous. And if you're able to disperse it into that large amount of water, you are able to help get rid of the problem because the microbial action can chomp away at it and get it out of the way for you. And that is what we were very lucky happened. It apparently was not as serious a problem as we predicted it would. Now, we've got a lot of work to do to figure out what the long-term effects are going to be and what the actual situation will be in the future. So here's what we know. Acute effects were much less than many people feared, including me. And when I make that statement, I get hate email. It's unfortunate, but that's the case. Chronic effects are very, very difficult to deal with. Causes and effects are hard to relate directly. And then as time passes, the crime scene gets old, and it's harder to figure out what happened. Sublethal effects are what we're concerned about now. We're not concerned about the immediate acute problems that we've seen in the past. Okay, so where'd all the oil go? NOAA released the National Incident Command actually released a budget on August 4th that provided this wonderful pie diagram. And I just shook my head when it came out, and I said, oh, they're going to be nailed to the cross by a lot of scientists on this one. And sure enough, the scientific reaction was not good at all. It was a reasonable approximation. I don't want to say they were completely wrong and that they didn't use science in producing this. But when Carol Browner went out on all the morning news shows to roll this out, she said, well, we've got 26%, 25% left or whatever it was, 26 is residual, and all the rest is gone. And it was pointed out by scientific heads that just because you couldn't find it didn't mean it wasn't still there. And so the administration was really beaten up over this thing. I think the oil budget's important. You need to do this sort of thing, but I think you got to be very, very careful how you do it. Later on in November, November 24th, they did a revision of this, which is not terribly different, but perhaps with better scientific input, and they did a better peer review job on this one. I don't want to make it seem as if anybody was asleep at the switch here. They were trying their level best to do something that was very important. But politically, this kind of thing is a bomb. Now, what do we deal with as we try to deal with spills? And this is where the whole point of the talk comes in. We have the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, and it created, in this case, Unified Incident Command with the Coast Guard in charge. And their focus is not on doing science. Their focus is on containing the spill and getting rid of the oil. We have the trustees, the states, et cetera, and the responsible party, BP, who are compelled to work together to try to solve the problem. And that creates many apparent conflicts of interest in the minds of the media. But frankly, oil companies know how to deal with spills. The federal government doesn't. I mean, how to deal with petroleum engineering. The federal government has little expertise in that area. Natural resource damage assessment must be done. We've got to figure out what's ecological damage and try to value it in economic terms. So NOAA leads this effort with Fish and Wildlife behind it, and that is essentially a litigation in the end. And all of the kinds of constraints that are involved with litigation are pertinent here, as they absolutely should be. This is not an exercise in getting the best science done. It can't be, and it shouldn't be. Very little funding was available for independent scientific research. The president made the determination that the polluter pays, responsible party, is in charge here, and they're the ones that have to pay for this thing. And Bob Gagosian of Ocean Leadership and I wrote an op-ed to the Washington Post last summer expressing our concerns about this approach. I still have them. So the natural resource damage assessment determines the cost of restoring, rehabilitating, replacing, blah, 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 natural resources. It does not talk about doing science. The Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, another element of OPA 90, is to help pay removal costs, et cetera. Blah, 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 restoration, rehabilitation, does not mention science. So there really is no fund that is specifically dedicated to doing science, although to be sure, some of the monies in each of these activities are used for scientific purposes. So let's talk about feds versus universities. If I'm going to whine so much about not being included by the feds, let me tell you what the feds have to work with. Well, they're a command and control capacity. They've got one CEO, the president. We have what I refer to as a herding cats management. And anybody that's been affiliated with the university certainly understands that. There are 15 executive departments, some of the military, under the command of the president. When he says jump, they say how high. When we take our 282 doctoral granting institutions that grant 20 or more PhDs and try to tell scientists in our fold what to do, they you say jump how high, and they laugh how loud. So that's a real problem. And of course, all these universities are fighting with each other to garner resources, fame, and the like. So you have an inherently intractable situation here. The feds have operational capabilities and enormous capacities. Yet universities are incredible reservoirs of information and knowledge and the ability to do new things. And that's what we need to be able to get into play in a situation like this. We've got to be adaptive. We've got to be able to use the best and most modern techniques to assess the situation and learn how to respond to it. The feds have to use the NERDA process. That's what the law says. They don't have the option to just spend a lot of money outside of that. We, of course, want unrestricted grants. We want NSF-type grants. And incidentally, I mentioned today at luncheon that the NSF did a terrific job getting RAPIDS out, and we really appreciate that. But for the applied agencies, there is no mechanism. For the mission agencies, like NOAA, there's no really good mechanism for them to do that sort of thing. The data that the feds collect has to stand up in court. They've got to use standard approved methods. They can't go out on a limb and use the most modern technique, because then some lawyer is going to say, you don't really know it worked right. We like to collect using state-of-the-art. We are constantly pushing the margins, and that may not be legally defensible. The feds have money. They can print it, for gosh sakes. We need money, and we need a lot of it. So here's some of the money we've gotten. We're very grateful for this. The BP did give out some money already as part of their Gulf Research Initiative. I had the good fortune of being mentioned in their first press release. That also resulted in me getting a lot of calls because everybody thought I had $500 million in my pocket that I'd be doling out. It was an interesting thing. So far, $40 million has been given out, $5 million to LSU directly, $10 million to Florida Institute of Oceanography, $5 million to Alabama universities, $10 million to NIEHS, federal agency. And then just recently, BP announced that the year two of the RFP would be happening. So this is the science funding that's essentially available. About a year ago, I mentioned to a very high-ranking federal official that we were desperate for research funding. And she said, I'm going right back to Washington, and I will, and this is not Lisa Jackson, not anybody I mentioned before. She said, I will look into this because I understand what you need. And then I got an email from her a couple of weeks later, and they say, well, I hear you got BP funding. Use that. And that was the end. I have to say I was not happy. That's what caused that article to be printed in the Washington Post. So is there any good news in all this? Well, certainly there's been a huge press interest in environment and energy. And that's an important dialogue for this nation to have, because we got an energy problem, folks. And any time you develop any energy resource, it has an environmental impact. There is no perfect source of energy, especially in the volumes we need it. For us, it was a teachable moment. It was a good case to bring the value of oceanography to the fore. And so that was a bit fun. We established a program at LSU called Environmentors, which is part of a national program with the National Council of Science and the Environment here in D.C. And this enabled us to link up with a high school. And believe me, these kids who came from impoverished backgrounds and, parents that never finished high school had embraced the intellectual issues of the oil spill and really wanted to do something. We were very lucky that the relief well went as fast as it went. It, like the President's Commission, the report was early and so was the relief well. And it worked. We were very fortunate with that. We're cooperating in ways we hadn't before. The Gulf universities have organized, and Now we're starting to speak with more or less a single voice, as best universities can do. We've done a similar thing in Louisiana, which is a historically fractious environment. So that's good. And as I said, energy is a topic of national discussion, which it damn well ought to be. We've also gotten our 20 minutes of fame. Here is my colleague, Ed Overton, whom I'm sure every one of you has heard in some way, because he's been on every morning show, every evening show, every everything, did a wonderful segment with David Letterman, who somehow made the spill risque. I don't know how exactly he was able to do that. So what are my thoughts and recommendations? We need to do a better job of consulting with and including the academic science community in complex situations like the Macondo spill. This ain't easy to do, and so I'm not going to be too captious in my comments about that. We need a non-NERDA federal funding for research, perhaps to establish a national oil spill trust fund. I don't know, but some independent source of money put away in a lockbox that we can do continuing research and draw on in the future. We should involve science much more explicitly in things like the reauthorization of the Oil Pollution Act, in terms of Department of Homeland Security and FEMA. If you look through FEMA's materials, they talk hardly anything about science. And with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement. And I'm pleased to say that in our conversation with Director Bromwich this week, he clearly recognizes that, and he intends to do it. The challenge he has is there are a few people in Congress that don't agree with the federal government getting money. And we have a problem with debt, as you well know. And maybe there are larger active roles for the Office of Science and Technology Policy and the National Academy here. I think that more can be done in coordinating. I don't want to be too critical of the Obama administration's OSTP function, but at the time the spill was going on, their focus was only partially on the spill. It wasn't to try to find a way to improve the communication and bring things together at the level I think we need. That's it. Thank you.
Should I stand up for questions? Yes.
Yeah, take some questions.
Be glad to. Yes.
Steve and Chu set up this five-member team of expert scientists. Did they make a significant contribution?
Yes. It's nice having a Nobel Prize winner around every once in a while. And I'm told, and I have no firsthand knowledge of this, so this is pure secondhand, but I'm told they were extremely influential in helping to come with the decision to make, to put the cap in and to how to do it. So I think that the federal role was more than we might have expected.
Yeah. They mobilized the nuclear emergency response teams to do radiography of the preventer and the valves.
And that's a good case of one function kind of being helpful in another area. And that kind of cross-coordination is really needed. And the way in the back.
There are discussions about other issues besides money in your research, like access to samples and space to pour out of preserve access. How big a problem do you think that is?
Well, a lot of the data are out there, so the issue is more knowing where they are and what they mean and all that sort of stuff. It's like we have so much data that we can potentially deal with, we don't know where to go for what. So somebody needs to organize this information, and the government, the part the government keeps quiet is what the case they're building is. And I can't fault them for that. You know, if you're going into court, you don't tell the opposition what your legal position is going to be. But we've got this fundamental dichotomy. We've got a legal situation here, and we've got a scientific situation here. The legal side is going to use old methods, standard methods, tried and true methods. We're going to use the cutting edge stuff. So it's a real challenge for us. I'm not sure I have any answers there. Yeah.
So the state had an oil spill plan, and it didn't include the sand burns. Do you have any suggestions for including the state plan or including more science in the state plan and coordinating that with the federal and whatever, or
We remain at the ready to advise the state at all times. I'll say this. A lot of people have been critical of the governor for putting those berms in. On the other hand, the anxiety levels of the populations near where the spill was hitting the shore required that somebody in government look like they were doing something. So it may have been more a political gesture than an effective way of stopping the spill, but maybe it had value there. So I'm going to be charitable on that one. I will tell you that the scientific community was not uniformly behind the idea. Well, they are sciences. There's no question about it. And I don't want to imply that the NERDA does not rely on science for what it does. But its first goal isn't the conceptual side of understanding a situation and doing it the way we in the scientific community would do it. It is more on accomplishing a goal and assessing damages and trying to get to the restoration side. We're a little bit concerned right now. The Gulf Restoration Plan that has been proposed, $20 billion, does not have enough explicit science so that I think you can monitor as you go along what your progress is. I see Mike over there. He must be just dying to say something. You want to?
As a representative of the institution in one of those other states around the Gulf, I must rise to say, well, I'll take a little exception to the fact that your comment on Louisiana being hit the hardest. I think clearly on the acute side, near term, absolutely. I really am right in concert with your comment about the longer term chronic impact. And if history has taught us anything from Prince William Sound, it's years out that the impacts are really
bad. Absolutely.
Look at the herring fishery and everything else. But the question I've got for you is the GRI RFP that is out now. You no doubt have read through all of the language in that RFP, and there is much discussion about some of the language in there that some folks, some general counsels of some universities are interpreting as being restrictive of what can be done with the data or what other research the investigator can do if they're doing research under the GRI RFP in terms of freedom of information and things like that. Do you have any comments on
the first is yes, and I'm a former vice president for research, so I look at these things with that jaundiced eye, but I think you raise very valid concerns, and we're a little bit scared of what kinds of contracts are going to come our way. The other thing I'd point out that in my rather unfair lambasting of my colleague states to the east, the scientific resources in these other states are important and it's natural for us to work with them. And we have, in fact, established this alliance called the Gulf University Gulf University Research Collaborative, which includes our friends in Florida Institute of Oceanography. And I will disclose that I still have an adjunct position at USF, so I and a house, so I remain a Floridian too. But it's some of the claims for damages. I know there are people in Nebraska that have claimed that they've been hard hit. And, you know, I think Louisiana does deserve a little bit of a special attention here. And that's all I'm asking for.
I think that'll be the last word.
Is that a good last word?
I think that's a great way to end it.
Bring the money.
Let's bring more money.
Thanks very much.